This is Hemophilia Gene Therapy, From Dream to Reality, a show co-produced by the Canadian and Irish Hemophilia Societies. Here's your host, David Page.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to this video podcast co-produced by the Irish Hemophilia Society and the Canadian Hemophilia Society called Hemophilia Gene Therapy, From Dream to Reality. Over the last several years, gene therapy for hemophilia B has become a reality. Some received it through clinical trials, others received it after marketing authorizations and reimbursement approvals in their countries. Today, we'll talk to four of these people. Our ultimate question to them is, are you happy you made the decision to receive gene therapy? Why or why not? Let me introduce our four guests. From Canada, Stephen Brown. From the Netherlands, Dan Breederveld. From the UK, John Curley. And from Ireland, and my colleague in this production, Brian O'Mahony. So first, I'd like to ask each of you in turn where you live, what you do for a living, your age, and whether you received gene therapy in a clinical trial or after marketing authorization. And we'll start with Stephen in Canada.
Thanks, David. My name's Stephen Brown. I'm 50 years old. And as David said, I'm in Canada. I'm in Burlington, Ontario. I received gene therapy close to 6 years ago as part of the Pfizer clinical trial.
And Dan in the Netherlands.
Hi, I'm Dan Breederveld from Amsterdam, close to Amsterdam, living in a small village. Work as a company doctor, occupational health physician, and part-time carpenter. And I received my gene therapy in a clinical trial, phase 3 trial, 6 years ago, CSL Behring.
Thanks, Dan. And over to you, John.
Hello, I'm John Curley. I'm a welder in Portsmouth Dockyard. I live on Hayling Island, a little island next to Portsmouth. And I'm 55 years old, and I had my gene therapy 6 years ago as well.
It was a clinical trial, John?
A clinical trial, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it would be. The market authorizations have only been in the last year or two. And finally, Brian.
Yeah, hi, Davis. My name is Brian O'Mahony. I'm the chief executive of the Irish Hemophilia Society. I'm 67, and I had my gene therapy as part of the HOPE-B clinical trial 5.5 years ago.
I'm going to ask each of you in reverse order this time to explain how you came to the decision to take gene therapy. More precisely, what were your goals in choosing this treatment over factor concentrate prophylaxis? What did you know beforehand about the risks and benefits? Who did you talk to in making this decision? And do you think you had all the information that you needed to make that decision? So we'll start with Brian.
That's several questions in one. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm probably somewhat different because I was following the science on this for many years. And as CEO of the Irish Hemophilia Society, I was also responsible for encouraging many of the companies to come to Ireland to look at Ireland as a potential site for clinical trials. And we organized meetings with our members for them to discuss this and to look at the trials that were coming forward. In the course of looking at all the trial data, I became convinced that for me personally, the benefit risk ratio of taking part in one of the trials was positive. So I decided I would do this. I suppose my decision drivers, I like the idea of stopping prophylaxis. I was hoping to diminish the amount of chronic pain in my damaged joints. I wanted to be more active physically. And also, frankly, I wanted to see what life was like without having severe hemophilia. In terms of my goals, I was fully aware that I could set my own expectations, but they may not be met. Having said that, I was hoping for a factor 9 expression somewhere between 20 and 60%. I wasn't greedy looking for 100. I was hoping it would last for at least 10 years. And as I said, I was hoping to have a decreased chronic pain in my thyroid joints. So who did I speak to? Somewhat different than many. My family trusted my views on this, so we didn't have a lot of conversations about this, but I had quite a few conversations with clinical colleagues and friends around the world, because as you well know, Dave, we have a large network of colleagues who work in this area. So I talked to a lot of people, some people who thought it was a good idea for me to do this, some thought it was a bad idea, and I listened to all opinions and then made my own informed decision.
So you had access to a lot of information. John, perhaps that wasn't your case. Could you tell us about your decision-making process, the drivers, your goals?
I was a bit isolated in the Portsmouth area. I never grew up knowing any other haemophiliacs or what they did. It wasn't until probably about 20 years ago that they asked me to go up to Basingstoke to a proper haemophilia centre to meet a woman called Savita Rangan. Does everyone know her? And she was the head of the haemophilia centre there. And she asked me to do some clinical trials for her. She always said, look, John, if anything comes, like any cure comes about, you'll be first in line if you do this stuff for us. So I did loads of trials anyway. I always had full confidence that I wouldn't be killed or die. So I did loads of trials and it was all fine. And then she just said, oh, there's a one called the Hope B actually come up. Would you like to do it? It's a cure. I didn't ask anyone or query. I just said, yeah, I'll do it. I just didn't want to be a hemophiliac. I just wanted to be like a normal human. So, and it all just went smoothly and it all just went fine. Yeah. I never had any worries at all.
As a welder, did you have some goals in perhaps, you know, improving your health so you could continue in that kind of very demanding job?
The main thing was hiding it all the time. Only a few people knew I was hemophiliac and died because the majority of them didn't exist. Because obviously years ago, there was the HIV and hepatitis thing and all that. And you said you had to hide it. I wouldn't have got any work otherwise. So I was always sort of like hidden. So part of the reason was as well. So I was like, I'm not hemophiliac anymore, blah, blah, blah. So that was one of the reasons. I suppose it did affect me. Sometimes if I used to get bleeds into my like elbows or something, I think, oh God, you know, maybe it will stop all that, which it did. I was never on prophylaxis, by the way. No one ever offered me prophylaxis. It was just as and when I got hurt. So the thing was, I didn't want to be a hemophiliac. I wanted to just get on with life, blah, blah, blah. And it worked. You know, I had full confidence in everyone. You know, I don't know whether I shouldn't have, but yeah.
Two very different perspectives there. One, you know, very well informed. Another one, trusting that it would work out. Dan, where do you fit in that picture?
Well, somewhere in between, because I think it's very rare that you're so well informed as Brian is. But being a medical doctor myself, I was, of course, not on top of the science around gene therapy, but I did follow it since the 90s, actually, since they were experimenting on mice and dogs. And I dreamt, actually, when I was in elementary school, I told the teacher, everybody around me wanted to be a fireman or a policeman. And I said, I want to be a professor who will invent a pill against hemophilia. So, yes, I was also dreaming of a life without hemophilia. But then again, things went so slow that I didn't think that it would be for me in my life. And then my physician pointed out that there was a phase one trial. Then my kids were very small and I just, the risks and benefits were not in favor of joining the study. And then I know about 2018 that he asked me and said, well, there's now a new study and they've changed things a bit and it's in favor of the results, we think. And we've seen preliminary results and they seem very good. Would you like to join? Because this might be your last chance of having even gene therapy, because maybe it will not be reimbursed in the Netherlands because the population is so small in our country that I'm very sorry to say that he was right, because it wasn't reimbursed to 1 month ago by the Dutch government. So I just thought this is my last chance. I have to go for it. And then it took me half a year to really decide on going forward. And I knew about the risks. I knew about I might have to take prednisone if my liver enzymes went through the roof. But I didn't mind that because I've also had interferon treatment for my hepatitis C, chronic hepatitis C infection. And I thought, well, prednisone can't be any worse than taking interferon for one year and a half. So let's do it. And it took around 4 to 6 months to decide on. I consulted my physician. He provided me with articles, scientific articles, and I shared the results with my wife, with my children, with my father, who's a physician as well. So well-informed, I can say, but also depending on my physician.
Did you have some goals in terms of improving your health or having perhaps better outcomes than on factor IX prophylaxis?
Yeah, I didn't really think in percentages, but I knew that the preliminary results were about, well, tens of percentages that you could rise. And I thought, well, if it would be 10%, would be enough clinically. I had less than one, so I was a severe hemophiliac, and I would be very grateful to have around 10-20%. And I'm well above that now. So I haven't taken any prophylaxis since 2019.
And Stephen Brown in Canada, what was your whole process leading up to gene therapy?
Similar to Dan, I was approached about joining a trial much earlier. I think it was one of the phase two trials, and same reasoning. I had a new son, and at that point in time, it was just not the right time for me, given that the science was still a little new and the risk with my new son. When I was approached again to do it, it was one where I didn't have to make a decision right away as part of the trial, because there was a lead into the trial. So it was like, gave me an opportunity to really start getting involved in it, I'm really close with the doctors at my hemophilia clinic. I also, Dan mentioned as well, one of the reasons why I wanted to do it is as my day job is as a health economist, getting market access and reimbursement. And I had literally said that to my hematologist. I'm like, this might be my only chance to actually receive this because I do not know what the market authorization will be. Canada did authorize it, from my understanding.
It's not reimbursed yet, though.
It's not reimbursed yet, but it is. It's gone through. But yeah, and I really just talked it over with my wife. I am a little bit more knowledgeable. I also have a PhD in molecular biology. And going through all of that, I had always said that hemophilia B specifically, was like the poster child for gene therapy. Small molecule, you just need to get it exposed in the blood, and it can have a great impact. So there was part of me that just having a PhD, going through the times since Dolly the sheep had been cloned to actually receiving gene therapy myself was, you know, kind of a cool factor. There is the part of me also that I'm very appreciative of all the older hemophiliacs that went through all the trials in the past, you know, to get things like the long lasting and recombinant factors that we did. And I felt it was a little bit of my duty to try to do that opportunity, as well as I do have a son. He's very active. I'm getting into that old age, and it would be nice to, you know, slow down some of the damage in my joints so that maybe I can be a little bit more active in future. That was kind of my rationale.
Staying with you, Stephen, how was the day of infusion? Was it a big deal?
It was a huge deal. It was the first time in Canada that they had done this, and just the red tape to handle an infectious product was a lot of work. It took a lot of collaboration with a lot of different groups, including like the pharmacists, the research labs, as well as the hematologists and clinic. When I was there, everybody's all gowned up, masked. You know, I'm here sitting in a t-shirt waiting for it. And, you know, I think there were a lot of people that came down to see me that day. I have lots of great pictures. One of my old hematologists came down to visit because, you know, it was seen as a very, you know, a breakthrough, crossing that line of offering a potential cure. I use the word cure very, very loosely here. But yeah, it was a big deal.
Dan, a big deal for you in Holland?
Actually, taking decision was a big deal. And then after I took the decision, I knew I was entering a process I could not stop. And I didn't want to stop. And it was more of a big deal for my treatment team, actually, because they were all dressed up in suits and masks, and was before Corona. So we weren't used to that yet. And it was crazy. But I was just there sitting in my t-shirt as well and just enjoying the scenery, and took the shot, lay down for an hour. And then they told me, oh, you can go for a walk in the hospital. You can have some lunch and just return in half an hour, 45 minutes, and then we'll see how you're doing. So yeah, it was relaxing. Was sometimes I say it was the most uneventful day of my life, but life changing. So yeah.
And John, how did it go for you on dosing day?
No one told me it was infectious. They just said, oh, it was like a build up, and they said, oh, John, on like this day, can you come in and we'll inject you? And I went, oh, okay then. I don't know what I was expecting, but it was like on a drip. I thought they just like give me an injection on the arm, but it was like a clear fluid. And my wife was there, and I didn't know it was like dangerous or anything. Was it infectious? Was it? I think a couple of people might have had gangs on or something, but they put a drip in my arm and it took about an hour to infuse. I say, I don't know what I was expected to happen, like a big marching band or something come out. I don't know. But it just all went smooth. And they said, oh, once it was done, I said, oh, is that it? And they went, yeah. And then I had to go and sit in the room next door, lie down on the bed. And it was after about 2-3 hours. They said, oh, we have to feel all right. I said, yeah. They said, oh, you can go home now then. It was all uneventful. It was an event, and then it was uneventful. I don't know. I don't know what I was expecting, but it took about maybe 3 weeks to actually start to build up the clotting factor. I think I'm probably the least educated here, and I don't know if ignorance is bliss, but they didn't used to tell me a lot. I just go, okay, then. But it worked. Everything they said would happen, happened. So I was pretty fine with that. I always had confidence in them. But I suppose it took half a day total. I had to drive to Southampton, put a drip in, a line of gurney, took about an hour, and then I got up, went to another room, lied on the bed, and then, yeah, told to go home, yeah, it's all fine. And then, obviously, every other week, I used to come back for a blood test and that, and it's, yeah, it's all pretty simple. It all went exactly how they said it would. So, you know, yeah, brilliant and uneventful.
So, Brian, I guess you were a bit more prepared for your experience.
Just to be sure, John, first, John, the gene therapy vector was not infectious. It's an attenuated virus. It doesn't cause any infection. It's harmless. It's just a delivery vehicle really for the piece of DNA No, look, I would agree with what Dan said as well. It's quite an eventful day in terms of potentially life changing, but it's also very uneventful. It's very boring. In fact, you go in, they set up an intravenous drip, takes about an hour and a half. You sit for a couple of hours and then you go home. Now, I was the first person in the hospital to get any sort of gene therapy. So I was quite relaxed, but there were nurses, research nurses, doctors all gowned up. There was the hospital director, the research director, their PR team were outside. There was a crash team in case something went wrong. So I was quite relaxed until I see about 20 people outside, which says, what's going on here? Having said that, I'd made it clear I was also going to speak publicly about this. So hence, I'd given permission for their PR team to be there. No, it was very uneventful. You know, you get the infusion. They're just watching to make sure there's no sort of infusion reaction. And then takes an hour and a half. You stay for a couple of hours and then you go home. Now, I did find when I went home that night that I was kind of emotionally drained because it was an uneventful clinical procedure. But, you know, intellectually, I knew this is a big deal. This is a potentially life-changing day. So I was tired that night when I went home just from the sheer importance of the event.
Let's move on to the follow-up because the follow-up is a bit different. It may be more of a big deal than just the dosing day. Brian, how did that go for you in terms of the rigor of all the testing in the 6 months following the administration?
The first 3 months is especially onerous because you're going in once a week, every week for 3 months. And in fact, I decided to go in twice a week and have some extra transaminases done twice a week just to make sure that that was all stable.
What's the purpose of this frequency?
Well, Dan mentioned that you might have to take prednisone. When the gene therapy goes to your liver, quite understandably, in some people, the liver reacts and gets a bit inflamed. It doesn't really cause any serious liver damage, but that inflammation can kill off the gene therapy in the liver cells where it's taken hold. So it's very, very important if your liver enzymes start going up at all that you spot that straight away and you start steroids. The protocol was once a week. I actually went in twice a week to do that. It was quite funny in the sense because in the lead-up period, which was quite long, about 6 months, I was doing a lot of negotiation with the research nurse about which days I'd come in for follow-up tests, and I was still trying to squeeze in some of my work and travel abroad. And then, of course, all that went away because the week after my gene therapy, COVID happened. So there was no travel for 2 years. So in one sense, COVID made it easier for me to do the follow-up because you couldn't go anywhere. On the other hand, it made it more difficult because at a time when everybody is avoiding hospitals, you're constantly going to hospitals. I have to say they managed it extremely well by bringing me into a non-clinical area. But certainly with a clinical trial, the follow-up is more intense than with a licensed gene therapy. But even with a licensed gene therapy, there's quite a lot of follow-up. So that's something that has to be factored into your life. You have to think, okay, if I'm going to do gene therapy, hopefully in the longer run, it will free a lot of my time from dealing with the centers. But in the first year, it certainly does not do that. You'll probably never be in the center as often as you are in the first year after gene therapy, because there are a lot of visits. First 3 months is every week, then every month, then every 6 months after the first year. So it gets much easier after the first year. But the first year, you certainly have to plan that, and you have to plan how that's going to be done, where the blood's going to be taken, and so on and so forth. So that's really, really important to factor that into your work or college life at the start.
John, you're a welder. You live on an island. Was the follow-up easy for you, or was it really a challenge?
Yeah, funny enough, I was working for a private company. I work for the government now, but I was working for a private company, and they was all right about it. I said, look, I'm doing some experimental stuff. I said, oh, it's really secret on top. I said, I'll have to disappear off for a couple of hours a week. I was all right with it. And they said, all right, then. I used to say, like, make sure we clock out. I didn't, but I used to say, like, you know, make sure we clock out, and that's fine by us. So, yeah, it used to take me probably an hour to get there, and blood tests, and then it's no big deal. I didn't think it was a big deal considering what I received. As Brian said, once a week we'd go there. I don't know if it's for 3 or 6 months for blood and urine samples and things like that. But I never ever thought it was a big deal. Do you know what I did used to like? They used to text me, oh, John, your blood level, your clotting factor's gone up to like 20%. Then it was 25%. Then it was 30%. You know, and I used to get all excited about it. Oh, that's what, you know. And when it started to get up around about 45, 50%, I started to get a bit concerned. And I was going, no, it's all right. You know, you'll be all right. Don't worry. We've got things in place. Because I thought, oh, bloody hell, I might, you know, have a heart attack or something like that. But no, it all worked out fine. I think it stopped at around about 55%. And it has been that. But they fluctuate actually between 50 and 55% for the last, like, 4 years, maybe. And yeah, it was all really fine. It all just went really smooth, exactly what they said would happen. happened. And I go back now once every 6 months. I don't have to, but they asked me, would I? And I said, yes. So once every 6 months, I go for a ultrasound scan and a blood test. And that's it. It's no big deal. There's no hardship on me. And no, it's fine. It's a small price to pay for what you get.
And Dan, how was your experience post-administration?
I fully agree with John here. It's a very small sacrifice. Also considering, well, what if the gene therapy would not succeed? Then I would, well, at least contribute with all the blood samples to more knowledge about the gene therapy and what would make it more successful. And yeah, it was exciting for me to see my levels go up. But actually, even before I had my first blood tests done or communicated with me, I didn't know my levels, actually. I think it was 8 or 9 days after my gene therapy. I fell down on a concrete floor. I tried some nasty toy of the kids, which was spinning on an electromotor. I shouldn't have done it, but I tried it. I tried to ride it, and then I fell down on my left hip. And everybody around me just scared as hell, because normally this would mean I would ride off to the hospital and need to treat myself with product and things like that. And I said, well, this is nice. Let's see what happens. And I didn't treat myself. I even didn't have a hematoma, I bleed, nothing. So I knew it was successful. That was really not a proof of the pudding. So it was great. And yeah, my levels went up till 20-22%. And then after a year and a half, they went up further until the 42 I'm at now. So I'm very, very happy with that.
And Stephen, was your experience somewhat similar?
I will be the odd man out. My experience was a little bit not quite as positive. So again, part of the clinical trial, much more involved. So was going back to the hospital, I think 24 hours, 48 hours, I think 72 hours, that slowly tapered. Blood work was twice a week. When I stopped going to the hospital frequently, they had a mobile phlebotomist come to my house to do the blood work twice a week. That was not the greatest experience. The first few times took 3 hours because they were trying to process samples in my house. And I was like, this can't continue because I have to go to work. Also, I did have a liver response. So I did get put on prednisone, which changed things quite dramatically. I knew about the risks of the prednisone. I don't think I fully appreciated what the dose of prednisone would do, more from like my mental health perspective, massive insomnia. And I just didn't really feel like myself. So I appreciate all those people that have been through prednisone. I mean, it's very, very hard. Layered on top of that was COVID. So there was a big concern about me being on prednisone in the beginning with COVID. So they tapered me quite quickly, probably quicker than what the protocol, and I had to redose back up, not to the full amount afterwards.
How long were you on prednisone?
So I started prednisone, I think probably around February, and I think I finally got off of it sometime in the summer, like July, August. So about 6 months total by the time, because I got tapered and then backed up.
How did your wife find that?
She loved it because part of my prednisone manic phases, I kind of nested and I organized and cleaned, because I don't know what that's about, but that was a thing when you can't sleep at 2 a.m. Just this urge to clean your cupboards and organize everything into this neatness. It was a little bit more involved. And then the mobile phlebotomist, it turned out, didn't really matter, because once COVID hit, the mobile phlebotomist actually ended up with a centrifuge on my dining room table and would process samples for 4 hours until delivery on the opposite side of my monitor as I worked, because all the places for them to do that externally were now shut down. So it was very different, a little bit of different experience. I do agree, though. It's very cool to see your levels go up. Mine dropped again a little bit.
Let's get to that. The big question, how did things turn out in the end? Not only in terms of levels, but also in terms of how your joints feel and how much you're bleeding.
My levels started to fluctuate around 25%. They have dropped now down to about 15% since then. So I am definitely in the category of a mild hemophiliac. I have had bleeds. Now, granted, the majority of the bleeds have been in very bad target joints and have resolved very, very quickly. But in terms of joint health and just general health overall, I don't know if I can say it's just a placebo effect that it's given me confidence. But I went from looking into having an elbow replacement in my left elbow to now I can curl 25 pounds. It took a long time to get there, but I am in better shape now than I have been in my entire life. Unfortunately, it does not reverse the damage of my really bad joints, but I think it's helped me prolong how bad they are. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
And Dan, what's been your result, both in terms of levels, but in terms of overall health?
Actually feeling relieved and free, not depending on product or pharma anymore. And keeping in mind that, well, indeed, we had the HIV and the hep C period. And although all the products we use now are recombinant, you can never be sure. And, you know, if the factory had been in Ukraine, we've had a big problem in Europe. So that's a real relief, actually. And knowing that you're going to survive in the jungle is actually quite a nice feeling. Or you can die on something that normal people would also die from. But in terms of joint health, I didn't have any joint damage. I was very lucky. And at the same time, I had my first muscle rupture in a tennis tournament 2 years after my gene therapy because I ignored the pain. And I stretched and I stretched. And then until I looked in the mirror, and I thought, whoa, what's this? There's a dent in my muscle. So I torn my pectoral muscle. So that was quite odd.
It hemorrhaged as well? It bled as well?
It was a bit bluish and greenish, but it didn't count. Well,
doesn't protect you from everything in the world.
No, exactly. But in that sense, I had to get to know my body again in a way where the limits are, because normally a bleed would prevent me from going further. And now I thought, well, this can't be a bleed. So it's just cramp and I'm just going on. So that's new. But it's all luxury problems, I would say. I'm totally relieved I took it.
John, you've already mentioned that you gained quite a good level, around 50%. Have you seen a difference in terms of your joint health and your overall health?
I had weak ankles. That was about it. They used to tell me you get microbleeds. I didn't know this, because sometimes you get sore, I don't know. Then they said, oh, that's because you used to get microbleeds. I think it has improved. I think, as Dan said, psychologically as well, just the traveling and things like that, you feel so much freer. I used to be a keen cyclist. And I think my left hip's wearing out now. So they're looking at it now. I might have to have a hip replacement. I don't know how that's going to go. But no, as concerning the rest, I've not had a bleed. I've not had anything. I'll say there's been a couple of times I've actually cut myself and I've been amazed that it stopped. I was, you know, watching it just stop. And I was like, wow, bloody hell. You know, so my wife's over there. I can't think. I've not had any bleeds at all, have I? No, not one bleed. Not one thing's gone wrong. So, you know, it's pretty good. So if I have to have a hip replacement, I don't know how that's going to go. Maybe they have to give me some extra factor or something. I don't know. But they're looking into it. They're going to see. But no, it's just positive. I've got nothing negative to say. I mean, honestly, if I had something negative, it's like, you know, I would tell you. It's been nothing negative at all about this whole thing from start to finish. So it's been bloody marvellous. And, I hope other people can experience it. Because you know what? I'd say half of it was probably psychological. Just that, as Dan said, the freedom, it releases you from constantly watching whether the pavement's uneven or if there's a sharp object about, or it releases you from that. So, yeah, no, just absolutely fabulous, the whole thing.
Brian, you're a bit older than the others, and maybe your joints were not in quite as good a shape. How have you seen things after gene therapy? And tell us what your levels you achieved.
Well, I mean, before gene therapy, I had a knee replacement, an ankle fusion, elbow surgery. So, you know, quite a lot of existing joint damage, which, of course, does not reverse. Now, my factor levels have been very good, you know, between 50 and 65%. And right from the start, it's been very good. So certainly my joints feel a little better. I put that down to, in the first 2 years, gene therapy, time since knee replacement, and also not traveling and getting into a better exercise routine because I wasn't traveling because of COVID. I had two bleeds in the last 5.5 years, two minor bleeds. I also had factor for a couple of steroid injections. And I also had a brain lesion, which required a very lengthy surgery. The brain lesion was not due to the gene therapy, wasn't linked. And in fact, the amount of factor I used for a 12-hour brain surgery was quite small. But no, I've got no treatment remorse, no regrets. I think it was the right decision for me to take at the time. I don't regret it. I certainly think it's been nice to be free of prophylaxis. It's been nice to be able to travel without bringing factor with you. I probably don't have the same degree of psychological freedom as John or Dan mentioned, because, of course, my job is haemophilia. So I'm spending less time on my own haemophilia, which means I'm spending more time on others.
What's the one thing that surprised you most in this whole voyage, this whole journey?
Two things. One, after the first 3 months of the clinical trial, I did become iron deficient, and that was actually because of the sheer volume of blood they were taking every week. So that's something they need to factor in, that you can get iron deficiency. The second thing was, I mean, a year after the trial, I was up in the Dublin Mountains with my wife and children doing some hill walking, and I was up on a low stone wall, and I slipped and fell onto some rocks, and nothing, no bleed, nothing. Like Dan falling off the children's toy. That's quite a bizarre and very nice experience. I could tell very quickly this was not going to bleed. And I've had a couple of incidents like that since. Like, I was in Vienna last month. I turned around after leaving a building and I whacked my shin off a low concrete bollard, which was stippled, so it gashed my shin and then knocked me off balance. So I fell hard on concrete and hit my shoulder and my hand and my knee. And my knee was sore for 2 days. I put an ice pack on it. It wasn't a bleed. It was just sore. And that's fine. No bleed. So that is a strange feeling for all of us who've grown up with cerebral hemophilia, to see a situation where 100% you would have needed immediate factor and you don't need factor.
John, what surprised you most about your journey?
Probably more the psychological side. When they said this will work, John, I was really confident it's going to work. I said, John, this will work. It's all going to go. So I was pretty confident it would. So the psychological effect on me, I think that's what surprised me the most. As Brian said, traveling, not having to take injections with you, and the freedom of just, you know, I don't have to make sure there's a hospital near me or a fridge or that side of things. That's what surprised me the most, how much it actually really influenced my life. Even though I didn't want it to, it did. But yeah, so no, just the freedom, the psychological freedom to just, you know, do what you want. Well, obviously, you ain't being stupid. But yeah, that's what's great about it for me.
And Dan, what surprised you?
It's more or less in the same freedom category, I think. Before I had gene therapy, I could not forget. I had to be thoughtful all the time. I always thought when I engaged into new situations, okay, what would do this to my hemophilia? What's the nearest hospital? What would happen if I blah, 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 blah. Always worries in the background. And now I can forget. I may forget. And that's, yeah, it feels so rich and so privileged. I'm grateful. Yes.
Stephen, any surprises for you?
Not a surprise, because I think everybody else has already said the answer. It's a weird feeling going from a severe hemophiliac, wondering every ache and pain is a bleed, going now to wondering, is that even a bleed or is it something that I can go on and ignore? And as others have echoed, that you can, you know, sort of push through and worry about later. It's a very different feeling. I didn't think I'd be in my 50s and my major health problems right now are not my hemophilia, it's my allergies. You know, like that just sort of goes to say I see my allergist more than I see my hematologist. And in fact, I had to treat for a procedure recently and my son came in the room, 12 at the time. He's like, what are you doing? Like, he had never seen me treat, even though when he was younger, I would be treating frequently for my prophylaxis. So it's a very weird feeling to go having something that is always omnipresent in your life to now not so much. And it's been a little bit of a learning because it's not a cure for me. It's going from a severe to a mild. So now trying to live my life as a mild hemophiliac with all my learnings from a severe. So,
well, thanks to our four guests for a really stimulating discussion. We hope for our viewers and listeners that succeeded in making gene therapy for hemophilia B a little bit more real and understandable. And to learn more about gene therapy, we invite you to tune in for the other episodes in this series, Hemophilia Gene Therapy from Dream to Reality. And above all, for those who are interested and eligible for gene therapy, it's important to talk to your primary medical provider or your hematologist to better understand if gene therapy is right for you. Thanks, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Hemophilia Gene Therapy from Dream to Reality. This series was funded by CSL Behring via an education and disease awareness grant. CSL Behring has not influenced nor contributed to the content development or dissemination.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.